Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at KSFR.org, podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and you can find us at Facebook.com/Radio Cafe. I'd like now to welcome Stephen Fried. He is the author of the new book, Appetite for America, How Visionary Businessman Fred Harvey Built a Railroad Hospitality Empire That Civilized the West. Stephen Fried will be speaking about his book. It's a free lecture, book signing, and wine reception at 6 o'clock at the La Fonda Hotel here in Santa Fe, co-sponsored by Collected Works Bookstore. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
What's so interesting about this character, Fred Harvey, is that he was way, way far ahead of his time where culinary high standards were concerned in this part of the country.
Really, not just for that part of the country, I mean, really in the whole country. I mean, at the time that Fred Harvey started opening restaurants in the 1870s along the Atchison-Topeka and Santa Fe Railroad, there was good food in a few places in a handful of cities in America, in Chicago, in Philadelphia, in New York, in Boston, at a few hotels that had very high standards of cooking. And the rest of the country, America was known as a country that had amazing fresh food and no one who knew how to cook it. And this was a problem all over the country. Fred Harvey was a freight agent for many railroads in the Midwest. He was an English man who had come to America and made quite a reputation for himself as a freight agent. But what he was really not happy about was that every place he went on the trains, he had to eat terrible food and stay in horrible hotels. And basically as a midlife crisis, because he started this company in his early 40s, he began a company along the Santa Fe Railroad, taking over the eating houses and the depots and turning them into fine dining establishments, white tablecloth restaurants where cowboys had to wear a jacket to eat, attached to lunch rooms that were sort of the prototypes for our diners, and then little takeout coffee places that were sort of like the early Starbucks. Because coffee was a huge thing in the West, and there wasn't much freshly brewed coffee available, but you could get takeout coffee to take back on the train as well.
Let's back up. Fred Harvey was actually an Englishman born in 1835, and at the age of 18, he was completely broke, got on a ship, went to New York, and immediately made his way into the restaurant industry at the lowest level, dishwasher.
Sure, yeah. He was what they called a pot walloper. And he came, you know, on the boats, and the boats docked in lower Manhattan. And the lower, right where the boats docked is the Washington Market. And he basically got a job in a restaurant called Smith & McNell, which is right there in the Washington Market, and was your typical old-fashioned market restaurant that cooked whatever was fresh in the market at that time. And, you know, this really made an imprint on Fred, because later he created, by using the railroad cars and their ability to bring food, fresh food that was refrigerated, market restaurants along the railroads in places that had never seen fresh food before. So he worked in New York as a pot walloper, learned the restaurant business a bit, moved to St. Louis, where he wanted to make his fortune, opened a restaurant. It was quite a successful restaurant. His partner was a Southern sympathizer. When the Civil War came, obviously St. Louis was rocked. I'm in St. Louis today, by the way, as part of our train tour of Fred Harvey's America. And Fred lost his business. His partner ran off with all their money. He and his young wife and two kids were left broke. And he had to start over leaving the restaurant business. He got involved in the transportation industry, which at that time meant trains, boats, and stagecoaches, because Missouri and Kansas were the border between the places where people could ride trains and the places where there were no trains left yet.
Let's talk for a while, because this book goes beyond just the life of Fred Harvey and then his continuing empire after his death. But this whole time in the United States history of the rise of the railroads, it was huge, and it was crazy, and it was competitive, and it was unstandardized. Tell us about that time.
Yeah, I mean, one of the great opportunities for this book was really to look at a lot of things that we learned about in history, I think sometimes in a kind of a boring way. When I was learning this stuff to write the book, I was like, where was this stuff in my history class? I must have slept through all of it. And so I think that part of what's fascinating about seeing it through Fred Harvey's eyes is that we are used to seeing this part of history seen through the eyes of the presidents of railroads and the presidents of America and those kinds of people. Fred Harvey was at their level, but he had a much more kind of democratic company that had to work with all kinds of people. And so you really do get to see the America from a very broad point of view. And, you know, the railroads were bigger than the further west you went, the more the railroads were bigger than the federal government. And so the opportunity to look at the railroad business from someone who worked as a salesman in it and later became a legend in it was really quite fun, because the presidents of these railroads actually had great affection for Fred Harvey. Fred Harvey took care of their passengers. He was the human aspect, the creature comfort of a business that otherwise did not have that many creature comforts. I mean, what people used to joke about in the railroads was that freight doesn't complain. Taking care of passengers was considered a pain in the neck to these guys. They didn't know how to do it. That's why people like George Pullman, who created the first sleeping cars, and Fred Harvey were so legendary among train passengers, because they were the only ones who actually tried to take care of people besides moving them from one place to another. And especially, you know, in New Mexico, I mean, New Mexico obviously was a state that had first been created by the previous form of transportation, by the wagon trains and the Santa Fe Trail. And the way the railroads came into New Mexico and changed the very way New Mexico functioned because of where the trains went. I mean, the fact that the Santa Fe Railroad bypassed Santa Fe and, of course, changed the fortunes of the city forever. It's fascinating social history, which people know little glimpses of. I mean, I'm sure people in Santa Fe hear this in school, but it's very cool to be able to hear it through the eyes of people who were living through it and in business there.
What were people's train travelers' opportunities for being fed before Fred Harvey started doing what he did?
Oh, it was a nightmare. It was a national scandal. I mean, there were stories in the New York Times and in all the major papers about, you know, the sham of dining on the railroads the further you went west. I mean, the food was horrible. It was, none of it was fresh. And because the people had no choice, they would rip them off everywhere. It was very common to get off a train, order a meal. It would come about 5 minutes before the train was ready to go. You couldn't eat it. They charged you, you paid, and they actually took the food and served it to the next idiot coming through who couldn't didn't have any opportunity to get good food either. The hotels were badly run. It was just a thing that people felt they could rip off the people who were on the trains coming through town. Fred Harvey's idea was that you would create a system all the way down the line so that basically everybody in each place knew they worked for one company whose standard was excellence, and that the people on the trains would be able to find them if they were unhappy. Because, you know, think of it, if you're passing through Albuquerque once in your life, if somebody rips you off, there's nothing you can do about it. But if you know that one company controls all the dining facilities from Chicago to L.A., that company has to be responsible. Fred Harvey took that responsibility really seriously, and he was the first person to ever do that.
Now, he got involved in the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad. And that was a company that had a reputation for being quite bold.
It was quite bold. They were for their time pretty high-minded. It's kind of the second wave of American railroading, because, of course, the first wave was the first transcontinental railroad, which was built along a route that at the time everybody thought would be really important, connecting Omaha and Sacramento, California. That was the first route all the way across America. It turned out that the second major route across America, the one that went through New Mexico and crossed over New Mexico and Arizona into Southern California to Los Angeles, that was the Santa Fe Railroad. That became the much more dominant route, especially for passengers. So it was an amazing time. The railroads were, as I said, bigger than the federal government. And the people that ran them, however, were regular people. You just don't get to read about them very much because they weren't really known that much as people. But to Fred Harvey, they were. They were his friends, and they were in businesses together. And the book can be actually, there are places where, you know, the friendship between these men is actually quite fascinating and quite powerful. I mean, when the president of the Santa Fe Railroad pulls Fred aside to tell him it's time for him to let his son run his business, that's the kind of thing you don't get to see in a lot of business stories. But to see it among people who affected so many people's lives, you know, it was really very fascinating to be able to write about stuff like that.
He was really a person with a natural instinct for business. He didn't go to business school. He was a penniless immigrant. And he had both this instinct for business and a real civilized sensibility that I guess he brought with him from England.
Yes. I mean, I think the thing about Fred that you understand is that this is a guy who understood the ambition of America, understood the aggressiveness of America, really liked those things, but also believed that there was a way to do that and be a gentleman and be principled. And especially in a world where you were doing business in lots of different cities and you might not see your employees for weeks or months at a time, you really had to find people whose word you could believe in and who had really high standards. And when you found out that somebody didn't have high standards, you had to get rid of them immediately because they could wreak havoc with your business and you wouldn't even know it for a really long time. So Fred stood for that even long before he went into the food business. What was interesting was to see all the things that had been written about him just as a freight agent for the many years he was a freight agent in the Midwest and West, because he already had that reputation. And when he brought it to the food service business and to the hotel business, it was only even more so something that people welcomed, because, you know, the joke was that anybody can run a restaurant, anybody can run a hotel, but nobody could run a great restaurant and a great hotel. It took somebody with real insight, real managerial insight, too. Fred wasn't a cook. He didn't believe that he could do everything. He was a brilliant manager of people. He knew how to choose people. He knew when how to get rid of people. But he always did it in a nice way. He was the kind of guy who figured that everybody he hired and everybody he fired could come back in his life at any time, which is a good way to do business.
We're talking to Stephen Fried about the book Appetite for America, about Fred Harvey. Now, Fred Harvey is quite well known in New Mexico, although I didn't know nearly as much about him before I read this book as I do now. But what were the first restaurants? Tell us about how he opened the Harvey Houses, and what are they called? Eating? They were called restaurants.
They were called eating houses. They weren't called, the word restaurants was not a common name, especially along the railroads. These were called railroad eating houses or depot eating houses. Basically, Fred Harvey lived in Leavenworth, Kansas. His business was based in Kansas City when Kansas City first started growing up. The earliest Harvey restaurants were in eastern Kansas. He actually ran three before he got involved with the Santa Fe Railroad very briefly. And then the first one for the Santa Fe was in Topeka. It was a lunchroom on the second floor of the Topeka Depot, which doesn't sound like a big deal, except the Santa Fe Railroad was based in Topeka, and all the executives ate there every day. So it was a testing ground, something that really mattered for him to turn into a good restaurant. And then several years after he opened that one in 1876, he did something quite audacious in Florence, Kansas, which is much smaller than Topeka. When the train came to town, you know, the population doubled or tripled. But he decided he would open a destination restaurant and hotel, like a boutique hotel, in Florence, Kansas, and hired the catering chef from the Palmer House in Chicago, the biggest hotel in Chicago, to come and create, you know, the greatest hotel in America that wasn't in Chicago, New York, you know, Philadelphia, or Boston, and immediately did so, and it became a sensation. I mean, I found out most of what I found out about the Florence Hotel from write-ups in the London newspapers about it. That's how famous it became very quickly. And from there, he expanded across Kansas, as the Santa Fe Railroad did. Santa Fe Railroad expanded through Dodge City, into southern Colorado, across the Raton Pass, and the taking of the Raton Pass, of course, is a classic bit of Colorado and New Mexico history, and then down into the along the Santa Fe Trail, through Raton, into Las Vegas, which was a huge city at that time. The company built both a trackside hotel and the famous Montezuma Hotel, the health resort up in the mountains outside of Las Vegas, which is now the One World University took it over and rehabbed it. They then built across New Mexico and down into the south of New Mexico, so Deming, Lamy. They skipped Santa Fe itself for reasons that are very much part of Santa Fe history, how the Santa Fe Railroad didn't actually build to Santa Fe.
Tell us more about that, actually.
Well, you know, it's a very fuzzy part of history, and you know, there have been many interesting books written about this, but the irony is, of course, that the Santa Fe Trail ended in Santa Fe, and it was, of course, where the Mexican trading and American trading met each other. When the Santa Fe Railroad came through to build, there have been many theories about whether this was mostly politics, whether it was mostly geography, but for a variety of reasons, it was decided in the late 1870s that the Santa Fe Railroad line would be better and easier to build, because, of course, you look for flat areas, so you don't have to build over too many hills. It would be easier to make it go through Lamy and to have the big city be Albuquerque. So the people in Santa Fe, some people were outraged by this, some people were fine with it, because the railroads were considered a mixed blessing. But lo and behold, Santa Fe, which was the capital of New Mexico and, you know, the most important city in the Southwest, ended up not being on the main line. And not being on the main line of the trains back then meant that you were a second-class city in terms of access. A branch line was made to Santa Fe, and of course Santa Fe continued to be a city, but Santa Fe turned out to be the first city in America to do what most other cities in America have had to do since losing their manufacturing base, which is turn itself partly into a place that makes money off tourists, because its main reason for being had been taken away, in this case, by the railroad. So it was a fascinating dynamic, and in fact, the Harveys personally loved Santa Fe, went there all the time. But, you know, the Santa Fe Railroad was first built through this area in the 1870s. The Fred Harvey Company didn't open a hotel in Santa Fe until 1926. That's a long period of time. And Santa Fe was very much affected by this. So Lamy had the Fred Harvey Hotel and the Santa Fe Depot. But the main depot and the place that the company really ran out of New Mexico was Albuquerque. Albuquerque became the capital of New Mexico for the Santa Fe Railroad, which at that time actually was bigger than probably the federal government or the state government in New Mexico. So it did change the geography and the sociology of New Mexico in a lot of interesting ways. And they later built in Clovis. So there were Harvey houses all over New Mexico. And it's also true that New Mexico changed the Fred Harvey Company probably more than any other state. And the reason is because it was much wilder in New Mexico than it was in the places they were used to operating in Kansas and in Colorado. So the Harvey girls were invented in New Mexico in 1883 because the African-American waiters who worked for the Fred Harvey Company before that were being terrorized by the cowboys, many of whom were from, you know, the South, who had left the South after the Civil War and were not happy being waited on by African-American men. There were stories in the Las Vegas newspapers about waiters carrying guns because they were afraid of the people they were waiting on. That's why the Harvey Company decided to start staffing all their restaurants with Midwestern women who they trained in the Midwest and then brought out to these places to sort of lower the testosterone level and calm down the cowboy West in New Mexico.
Well, that itself was an interesting story that I didn't know, that so many former Confederate soldiers who felt they just couldn't live with freed slaves in the South went West and ended up among other places, New Mexico.
Yeah, I didn't know it either. I mean, part of doing this book was sort of an endless process of being fascinated and surprised by history, little parts of history that appeared in all kinds of little different books. And then, I mean, hopefully, you know, that feeling of fascination that I had when I found these things out, made its way into the book, because it certainly was, you know, I had the same reaction when I heard about what you just described. It's like, you're kidding. Really? But of course, it made perfect sense.
Yeah.
If you see the movie Blazing Saddles, it's all right there.
Right, exactly. But
the thing is, you never think of it in terms of learning enough history. So as a journalist, my goal is to learn enough history to tell you that story authoritatively so that a historian will say, yes, he got the facts right, but also make it so that you would read it, because a lot of this is history that's probably been in books that we all fell asleep reading.
Right.
But the idea is to put it in a book that you would be fascinated by. And that was, you know, very much my goal, to take these stories, to weave them in with the Fred Harvey story and the story of America, and create a history book that I would read.
Well, it definitely is that. It's very well written. It's gripping. It reads like a novel, and you can, you know, see and hear and feel and smell the people. If you have the book handy, I was wondering whether you would read us the first couple of pages from the prologue, which give that beautiful contrast between the kind of Wild West cowboys and the Fred Harvey establishments.
Well, I do have the book handy, surprisingly enough. I do travel with one copy of it. Which part did you want me to read? The very beginning?
The very beginning.
Montezuma? Sure,
I'd be happy to. Prologue, and it's titled, Who the Hell is Fred Harvey?
Sure. Who the hell is Fred Harvey? On that spring night in 1882... the drunken cowboys riding through northern New Mexico could have been forgiven for squinting in disbelief at the Montezuma Hotel. It did appear to be a hallucination. The Montezuma was one of the most astonishing architectural creations in America, although perhaps most astonishing was its location. It was nestled in the gorgeous middle of nowhere in the foothills of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, 6 miles outside of Las Vegas, New Mexico, an old Santa Fe trail town that the railroad had only recently connected to civilization. The largest wood frame building in the United States, the Queen Anne-style Montezuma featured a dining room that seated 500, a casino, a breathtaking wine cellar, 11 bowling alleys, a billiard hall, and an immense therapeutic bathing facility offering 6 different kinds of baths and douches so patrons could fully experience the medicinal powers of the underground hot springs. The service at the Montezuma was brilliant, with staff imported from the best hotels in New York, London, Chicago, and St. Louis. And the cuisine was amazingly ambitious. The food combined the expertise of classically trained chefs from the restaurant capitals of the world with fresh regional American ingredients, fruits, vegetables, and shellfish, as well as delicacies like green turtles and sea celery harvested by pearl-diving Yaqui tribesmen, to which few other kitchens in the country had access, and which most chefs wouldn't come to fully appreciate for almost another century. Open for only a few weeks, the resort was already attracting dukes and princesses and presidents who quickly booked passage on the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe, the upstart railroad whose newly laid tracks were the only way to get there. So when Red John and his men approached on horseback that evening, they couldn't believe their bloodshot eyes. The cowboys rode first to the park, where they hollered and shot their guns in the air while galloping across the manicured bluegrass and graveled walks. The commotion could be heard throughout the hotel, from its grand entranceway to its cavernous main dining room. There it reached a tall, slim man in his mid-40s, with a perfectly groomed Van Dyke beard, deep, cautious eyes, and senses that were always cocked. He tried to ignore the noise and enjoy his dinner, but soon threw down his linen napkin and rose abruptly from his cane-backed chair. The man was dressed fastidiously in a dark blue suit with a waistcoat and dangling watch fob, the formal uniform of a Victorian gentleman from his homeland of England. But he walked quickly with the nervous energy of America, drawing the attention of the dining room staff and some of the guests as he passed. By the time he left the dining room, the cowboys had dismounted and were running riot through the hotel. He could hear them in the billiard hall where they were taking target practice with the Indian relics and curios displayed above the bar and shooting the tops off the private label liquor bottles on the sideboard. "Boys, put up your guns," the Englishman called out, striding into the room. "Who the hell are you?" Red John yelled. "My name is Fred Harvey," he replied. "I run this place, and I will not have any rowdies here. If you don't behave like gentlemen, you can't stay here and you can't come again. Now put up your guns and take a drink with Fred Harvey." Although he had been in America for 30 years, Fred still retained his British accent, which made some Westerners titter. But as the cowboys laughed, cursed, and taunted him, and hotel guests started gathering, he walked over and grabbed Red John by the collar. In a single motion, the fastidious Englishman yanked the dusty desperado over the bar and pinned him to the floor. "You mustn't swear in this place," he told the stunned cowboy. There was a moment of silence, and then Red John told his men to stand down. "Fred Harvey is a gentleman, boys," he declared, brushing himself off. "I say, let's have those drinks." When the drinks were done, they were served a midnight breakfast as well, the breakfast for which Fred Harvey was becoming famous. The freshest eggs and steak available in the country, shipped directly from farms in refrigerated train cars. Pan-sized wheat cakes stacked six high, quartered wedges of hot apple pie, and cup after cup of the best damn coffee these cowboys had ever tasted in their lives. Red John and his men never made trouble with the Montezuma again. But they still wanted to know, as did more and more people across the country, who the hell is Fred Harvey?
We're talking to Stephen Fried. The book is called Appetite for America, How Visionary Businessman Fred Harvey Built a Railroad Hospitality Empire That Civilized the West. Now, this hotel in Montezuma, this wonderful, amazing-sounding hotel, eating house, eating establishment, burned down, was rebuilt, and burned down again.
Yeah, it was great because the second time it burned down, they actually announced that it was absolutely fireproof. And it was designed, the second one, by Daniel Burnham from Chicago, who's better known for designing, you know, all the buildings in the White City for the World's Fair. But their hotel burned down, too. The one that's there now is the third one, and that one survived. It is an amazing building if you've never been there. It's a great day trip from Santa Fe.
Yeah, it's where the United World College is located. So let's talk more about the Harvey girls. Fred Harvey decided that it wasn't working to have African-American waiters in his restaurant, and he actually hired somebody else who had little or no experience in the restaurant business, who came up with the audacious idea of importing pretty young women from Kansas to be the waitresses.
Yeah, the gentleman who did it was actually a neighbor of his from Leavenworth. I mean, Fred's business grew so quickly that he basically took everybody that he knew and trusted in his life and sort of sucked them into the restaurant business, because he believed, and many great businessmen believe this, that it is easier to train somebody who doesn't know anything about your business and teach them the right way to do things than it is to import people who've been trained badly by somebody else. So Fred was very invested in this, and he did this, and the number of people who had been in his life in different ways and ended up in his restaurant business is quite amazing. So his next-door neighbor from Leavenworth is the one who came up with this idea when they decided to make him the new manager of the Raton, New Mexico Harvey House, which was one of the smaller ones right over when you come over the Raton Pass. And from there, they decided to do it all through the chain. So they began interviewing women first in Leavenworth in Kansas City. And as they needed more and more Harvey girls, they got them from all over the Midwest. And they trained them in the Midwest. And they were sort of trained like the first female army. This is the first female workforce in America, the first opportunity that single women had in this country to go have adventures, to see the country, to make their own money, to live independent lives. It was really quite an audacious thing to do. And the women that did it were really bold. I mean, we associate that kind of freedom and feminism with a time much later in American history. I think people mostly associate it first with the 1920s. But in fact, Harvey girls were this phenomenon which began in the 1880s. So by the time the Roaring Twenties came, there had already been 30 years of women in America who had had this incredible adventure of being Harvey girls. Some of them stuck with the Fred Harvey Company their whole lives. Some stayed the minimum 6 months that you had to stay. You basically had to sign a contract that's saying you wouldn't get married for 6 months after you came to the town, because many of the women did marry very quickly. And if you did that, you got a free train ticket on the Santa Fe to anywhere the Santa Fe went, which was, again, an incredible opportunity to travel. These women were just very adventurous. They were very cool women. You know, when I walk down the street in Santa Fe, where I think, you know, many of the world's cool women live, I think that, you know, a lot of the people who first came to the West thinking that it would be great to live there were people who came to work for the Fred Harvey Company.
Did you interview people who were descendants of the Harvey girls?
Yeah, well, there's actually, you know, there are still some living Harvey girls from the 1940s and 50s. In fact, we met at a Harvey girl reunion in San Diego some of the waitresses who had worked at La Fonda during the Manhattan Project. I mean, one of the many things you get to write about when you get to write about Fred Harvey is the fact that the Manhattan Project's watering hole was La Fonda Hotel. And those waitresses were there serving Oppenheimer and other people when they came back from testing the bomb. And, you know, this was a huge part of Santa Fe culture for a really long time. So, yeah, there are still living Harvey girls who had that experience. But what's also cool is the people who know that their grandmothers or grandmothers had that experience and really treasure that. And I've met a lot of people who have the diaries and date books. We actually published in the book probably the first new Harvey girl pictures that have been seen in 20 or 30 years. We found them in different collections held by family members, you know, very dearly, because they love the idea that their mothers, grandmothers, maybe even great-grandmothers by this time, came to the West to work for Fred Harvey as Harvey girls. And, you know, this was an amazing experience. I mean, there's one lovely thing that I found out about that I use in the book. In Lakin, Kansas, which at one time was the very end of the West before people came to New Mexico on the trains, the Harvey girls were the first ones they sewed the first flag the city ever had so they could have their July 4th celebration. So, you know, the Harvey girls had a big role in these towns beyond just being waitresses. I mean, in many of these cities, the Harvey girls had dances at the Harvey restaurants on Friday night, which were the only social event in the town that didn't involve drinking and prostitution.
And they were memorialized in Hollywood in a movie.
Yes, the 1946 movie The Harvey Girls with Judy Garland was actually one of the hugest movies ever made during its time. It won an Oscar for Best Song. It lives on. I wouldn't say it's the greatest movie in the world, but it's high camp. And what it does is that it really shows you that there was a time in this country that for a very long time where the Fred Harvey Company was a company that everybody in America knew about. The idea that you would make a movie about waitresses at a Fred Harvey restaurant is based on the idea that so many people knew who Fred Harvey was and knew the legend of Fred Harvey civilizing the West, that, of course, this is Judy Garland at the height of her career, not long after The Wizard of Oz and after Meet Me in St. Louis. I mean, this was the movie that she chose to make. It was a huge movie at the time. You know, that was the year The Best Years of Our Lives came out. I mean, a lot of movies that are really, really famous. And that movie lives on, partly because of the great songs that Johnny Mercer wrote for it.
Fred Harvey invented, large-scale purchasing practice that have been employed ever since by restaurant chains. And he really, if I understand correctly, invented the whole idea of a corporate chain.
Yeah, well, it wasn't corporate. I mean, it was a private company. It was the first national chain of restaurants, the first national chain of hotels. They had a chain of bookstores later. It was the first national chain of anything. Because basically, you know, before that, things were owned within a town. I mean, there might be a couple locations of a restaurant or a store in a town, but there were very few businesses that had locations in multiple cities. And the nature of Fred Harvey's business being in one depot in each of, you know, up to 80 places between Chicago and L.A. and later down from St. Louis down into Texas when the Santa Fe expanded there, the nature of his business was that he had to figure out how to run a national chain where you had to manage people in different cities at the same time, and much of this happened before telephone. So part of what they did was he would sneak off the train before the train made it into the depot and come and sort of terrorize the restaurant to make sure that everything was perfect, and if he wasn't, he would upend a table. They had to put it back together very quickly, and you know, the legend, you know, went around the system that you should always be afraid that Fred might jump off the train and, you know, and scare you to death, so you better do everything perfectly, which the Harvey girls always did. So part of it was just a management ability to not only pick great people, but to make the employees feel that at any time it was really important for them to treat their customers absolutely perfectly, or Fred Harvey would find out about it. And it was in a way kind of military. And but I think that the waitresses really enjoyed it because they felt they were part of a huge system that really stood for something. And it really did. I mean, you know, for years before there was even like a Good Housekeeping seal of approval, people thought of the Fred Harvey Company as being the gold standard for quality and service in this country. I mean, it was an amazing phenomenon, very much lost to people. I hope that they, you know, come to understand that a thing like this was possible. And I tend to think it's still possible. What Fred did still feels very modern to us today when you read about it. It doesn't feel like so much like an old cowboy story. It feels like a modern guy solving a problem that we have today. Every time I get off a plane, I think, God, I wish Fred Harvey was still here to make plane travel as comfortable as he made train travel, because plane travel is just as bad now as train travel was then.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and it's an interesting thing. I mean, the challenge of managing many restaurants in many different cities and states at the same time, as you say, is huge. And he did something that I don't think most chain restaurants, if any of them, do today, which is give chefs and managers some leeway to actually go out and get fresh local food and things like that. I mean, when you think of chain restaurants now, you think of the nadir of culinary experiences.
Yeah, what was interesting about Fred was that they actually did both things, in that they were very systematized by sending recipes down the line, in part because they knew that people were going to be going along the train and they wanted them to be able to eat different food at the different stops. So they weren't coming in and eating the same exact dish, didn't have the same exact menu to choose from when they were stopping at many Fred Harvey restaurants. So the system was both incredibly well systematized at a time that when most of this information was going out by telegraph, but also he knew that if he didn't give his chefs and his employees the opportunity to be, you know, this word that we hear a lot today, to be more entrepreneurial, that they would be bored and they wouldn't do their jobs well. So, in fact, he encouraged them, you know, if they found that there was some local hunter who had a big kill, or fishermen who caught a lot of fish, a farmer who had a lot of cantaloupes or something, their goal was buy all of them, take the ones you need, and put the rest of them in the railroad refrigerator car and send them up and down the line with some suggestions on how to prepare them. So this made the Harvey chefs very happy. It gave them the opportunity to be part of a system that was really well thought out and systematized, because no one wants complete freedom. What you want is a system that really works and the opportunity to free associate when it's a good thing for you. And that's what the Harvey Company stood for, and that's why the food was so inventive, so fresh, and why when you find these old sheafs of recipes, which is part of what I put together, the appendices, there's an appendix in the book that has over 50 recipes, most of them never before published. They come from these big sheafs of recipes that Harvey chefs held on to for years, because they represented all the stuff that was sent up and down the line by the company and by the different chefs.
We're talking to Stephen Fried about the book Appetite for America. On top of everything else, Fred Harvey was also involved in the ranching business.
Yes, early in Fred's life, you know, Fred was involved in every business. Whenever he had a dollar, he wanted to invest it in something else. He bought cattle when he was still a freight agent, and part of the way that he curried favor with his executives at the Santa Fe Railroad is he allowed them to buy into a cattle ranch that he had bought and taken over first in western Kansas, that later moved to Colorado. But he was really interested in ranching, and later in farming. The Fred Harvey Company, another thing that was very different about it was they raised their own cattle. They had their own dairy farms. They had their own vegetable farms. I mean, the company tried to control the quality of everything. There were bottling plants all over the country. The Newton, Kansas bottling plant was the only company in the country that had a license to bottle Coca-Cola, because Fred Harvey Company sold so much Coca-Cola that the company gave them that license. So he was in a lot of businesses, but this is because before Fred was in the restaurant business, he was a freight agent. Freight agents need to be able to learn a lot of different businesses. And that's what Fred was brilliant at, management and understanding different businessmen's needs. And it was an ability that he used. And, of course, look, Fred Harvey died in 1901. A lot of the things that we talk about with the Fred Harvey Company were done by his son, Ford. his right-hand man, David Benjamin, and even Ford's son, Freddie. Ford's son, Freddie, is really the one who was most involved in La Fonda Hotel. That was by the 1920s. The company was already moving into its third generation, still using Fred's basic ideas, but in a much more modern way.
Now, when Fred Harvey died, it was in his will that everything stay exactly the way it was in terms of how the company was run for another 10 years.
Yeah, it was kind of a brilliant way of managing from the grave to make sure that basically that they used his name as if he was still alive. They still signed everything Fred Harvey as if he was still signing it. And basically all their advertising said, you're being taken care of by Fred Harvey, your host Fred Harvey, and his son Ford, who not only was running the business for that 10 years, but Fred had been sick during the last years of his life, and Ford had already been running the business for a period of time. Ford is a character you get to know in the book who no one ever heard of before, because basically Ford was the one who had to pretend he was Fred for all those years, you know, at the end of his father's life and all the way into the 1920s. So he was actually quite a brilliant businessman. And in family business, it's so rare for a business to pass on to the son and for the son to be every bit as smart as the father, if not better. And Ford really was. He understood what his father was going for, but he made it be for a new generation. Ford's the one who built the Grand Canyon, which is what is left of the Fred Harvey Company, and what most of us really know about Fred Harvey is to still go to the Grand Canyon and to see those Grand Canyon hotels, which Ford himself was involved in creating. Fred knew they were going to do it, but it happened after he died. To see La Fonda and Santa Fe, which is something that the company invested in heavily in the 1920s, and in the Union Stations that built up after Fred's death, too, because they later started a business where they ran the Union Stations in Chicago, Kansas City, St. Louis. Not only the restaurants, all the stores. They owned all the bookstores west of the Mississippi. They were in the retail business and in the Native American art business, which certainly people in the Southwest know a lot about. I don't think people in Santa Fe know so much that it really was the Fred Harvey Company that created the major interface between all the Indian tribes and their craftsmen and the people who wanted to buy trinkets. And in fact, you know, a lot of the jewelry that people buy in Santa Fe, the lighter weight turquoise and light silver jewelry, which people think is of Native American design, it's of Native American manufacture. But that kind of design was actually created by the Fred Harvey Company to take what was typically Navajo silver jewelry, which was much heavier, much bigger stones, and turn it into something that would be more amenable to tourists who wanted to carry lighter things. So the Santa Fe style, both in terms of the architecture, which was very much pushed by the Fred Harvey Company and its brilliant architect, Mary Coulter, and that jewelry style that is so associated with Santa Fe, these things were created in partnership between the Native Americans and the Fred Harvey Company, a fascinating partnership which people still debate to this day, the pros and cons of it. But what is not debatable is that if not for the Fred Harvey Company, the Navajo weaving and the Navajo silver work probably would have disappeared. So the company is credited both with saving it and commercializing it together. And most of the museums in this country that have Native American art collections, much of that stuff was bought originally from the Fred Harvey Company.
Yeah, it is a sort of tension between preservation and exploitation.
Yes, and the Harveys were completely aware of that. They understood that they lived at that interface and that somebody had to be at that interface and do it well and do it responsibly. It's just like if you run the Grand Canyon as a concession, you are dealing both with the people who are going to be able to go camp there, appreciate the nature, hike down by themselves, and people who want to, as the Santa Fe arranged them to do, take a train to the lip of the Grand Canyon and experience it no more than you have to experience by sitting it on the front porch of El Tovar, sipping a mint julep. And, you know, they had to be there to, one, to take care of all those people, and two, to protect the canyon from tourists. And they did that in Santa Fe. They did that at the Grand Canyon. They did that all over northern New Mexico and Arizona in the areas that we now love. But that basic love-hate of tourism that people in Santa Fe know so well, it's very hardwired in all this. It goes back well over 100 years. And what's really interesting is to listen to the people from the Fred Harvey Company talk about it, because they talked about it a lot, especially Fort Harvey was very involved in the creation of the National Park Service. And in the hearings for the National Park Service, you can see these long talks from Fort Harvey trying to explain to people the difficulty of making sure that these national parks are available both for naturalists and just your hardcore tourist who wants to see the Grand Canyon for 10 minutes, and that it has to be there for all those people. So they really wrestled with this stuff in a very interesting way.
Since we're here in Santa Fe, let's talk about La Fonda for a minute. That was a Harvey house that was not on a train stop.
Yeah, La Fonda was, again, you know, it's something the Fred Harvey Company got into later because the Santa Fe did bypass Santa Fe. In the 1920s, in part because the Fred Harvey, because the Harveys themselves, especially Ford Harvey's children, Kitty and Freddie, were so in love with Santa Fe culture, and Santa Fe was starting to bubble up itself. I mean, artists were starting to come there. More and more people wanted to visit there. The Harvey Company decided to switch from just helping them by booking them at other people's hotels and decided to create their own hotel. They also created something which is much debated in the history of Santa Fe and New Mexico called Indian Detours. And the Indian Detours were a series of car tours where people took Harvey cars and were driven to all the pueblos. Now, it's not like people don't go to pueblos today, but the number of people who started going to pueblos dramatically increased because the Santa Fe Railroad and the Fred Harvey Company created these Indian Detours in the mid-1920s. And so that sort of love-hate relationship with tourism just rose precipitously. My favorite example of it is, of course, you know, when D.H. Lawrence came and took his Harvey tour of the snake to go to a snake dance, the first thing he wrote was this really mean essay about how horrible the snake dances were and how much they proved the way Indians were being exploited by everybody, what a nightmare this was. And then, like, a week later, he wrote another essay, the one that's much better known, about how the snake dances were the most perfect, you know, proof that the Indian culture was wonderful. And, you know, that love-hate of the snake dances is a perfect, you know, example of what I think people go through with tourism all the time. So the Harveys came in 26. They created Indian Detours. They created a new kind of Harvey girl, the Indian Detour Courier. These were college students who had to be bilingual and who were the ones who gave the first in-depth tours of Puye, of Acoma, of, you know, all the areas in northern New Mexico and northern Arizona that people now visit. They took people around to them for the first time. And it was actually something that only existed within the Fred Harvey Company for a few years. The Indian Detours closed, you know, when the Depression took it, but they took over La Fonda, doubled its size, and made it the center of life in Santa Fe, and that did not change. And then they later built a hotel in Winslow, La Posada, which continues to be in existence to this day, the idea being that people were going to go from Santa Fe through Winslow to the Grand Canyon and do these grand tours of the Southwest.
How did you come to this whole subject and then come to write this book?
Well, the biggest reason was my wife and I went to Grand Canyon, but the truth is the year before we went to Grand Canyon was the first time we ever came to the Southwest. A friend of ours has a cabin outside of Pecos, New Mexico, up in the mountains outside of Pecos, and that was the first time we'd ever set foot in the Southwest. And, of course, we had the typical Easterner, you know, experience. I must do everything I can to be able to come here as often as possible. Of course, the fishing up there is amazing. And so we had gone to that cabin up in Pecos, and then we went to the Grand Canyon in 1993. Fred Harvey's portrait hangs in the main lobby of El Tovar, the main hotel there. And when you go to your room, you get a little pamphlet about Fred Harvey that tells you a little bit about his story. And, you know, I thought right then this was like an amazing story I had never heard of before, something that really would maybe bear up under closer examination, I thought first as a magazine article. But it was just something that I paid attention to because we travel in the Southwest. And when you travel in the Southwest, you trip across Fred Harvey all the time because many of these cities were Fred Harvey cities. A lot of the people there originally came there to work for the Fred Harvey Company or for the railroad. And so by the time that I started thinking, you know, after 9/11, about doing a book on this, I really had learned a lot about the Southwest, a lot about the Fred Harvey Company, and thought I knew something about it, although honestly 6 years later I realized how little I knew when I agreed to write this book. But I must say that, you know, there was never any shortage of information because the Fred Harvey Company gives you access to like 70 years of American history through the most fascinating parts of America and things that people don't even know. I think people even in New Mexico don't know that much about the different historical periods that their cities went through to get to where they are today. So for an Easterner who is just totally in love with that area, to be able to recreate that and be there in my mind during the time when I'm not there, you know, there was never any, it was just a wonderful process. And I'm thrilled that we're coming back in. One of the main events we're doing on this tour is this huge event at La Fonda, which is really just warms my heart.
Yeah, and we'll give the information about that in just a couple of minutes. Just before we go, what kinds of materials and information did you find out in the process of researching this book that is unknown to even former scholars of Fred Harvey?
Well, I was very lucky. You know, the family, there are five living branches of the family, one of whom is in Santa Fe, but there are several of them who are in Boston, several of them who are in Chicago. It turned out they had many more of Fred Harvey's actual date books, letters between Fred and his son and his wife that anybody, even they, had realized. And a lot of the stuff was kind of squirreled away in closets and in basements. And I really pushed them to dig through everything they had. And when you saw all the stuff, they had many of Fred Harvey's date books. I could place him during many years of his life. So when you have access to that material for the first time and you get to cross-reference it with the material that scholars have had for a while, you get a really three-dimensional, really human way of telling this major American business story, this major American cultural story. And also there's a lot of Harvey Girl material. There's now a lot of diaries that are available and photos that weren't available before. So, I mean, I'm very fortunate. People did very good work before I got to it. Much of it was pretty academic, but it's great work. I was really able to benefit from what they did and then have the opportunity to write more personally about the Harveys and the people that worked for them because all these new materials became available.
And now you're on a train tour that follows the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad?
Yep. We started in Chicago. We did a night at the Chicago History Museum and at the Chicago Club, which many of the old railroaders were the original members of. We're in St. Louis right now, diverting a little bit from the main track of the ATSF, but Santa Fe was an ATSF city. We're going to Kansas City, to Topeka, where the Fred Harvey, obviously the first restaurant was, and then we're all taking the overnight train and getting off at Lamy. And in fact, many of the Harvey family members are going to be on the same train and will be in Santa Fe for these big events, which we are all really looking forward to.
Stephen Fried is the author of the new book, Appetite for America, How Visionary Businessman Fred Harvey Built a Railroad Hospitality Empire That Civilized the West. Stephen Fried, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great talking to you.
Stephen Fried will be speaking about his book tomorrow night at 6 o'clock. It's a free lecture and book signing and wine reception at La Fonda Hotel, co-sponsored by Collected Works Bookstore. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.